Do you remember back in junior high school, by the time you got to the last class of the day, you were just worn out? And you really didn't want anything to happen during that last class of the day other than to get to the final bell, right? There was no education that took place in that last class of the day. And so you get into that last class and everything's been kind of rough and you sit down and slump in your desk and all you want to do is just kind of ride out that last 55 minutes. And then the teacher comes in and says two words that wake you up and make you mad at the same time. You got it. What is it? Pop quiz. Well, tonight's the last class. So there's going to be a pop quiz. And the teacher says, put your books under your table and get out your Big Chief tablet and your pencil and answer the following questions. And furthermore, the questions count towards your grade for the semester. Now, I won't go quite that far because our final grade is not going to be dependent on the questions that I asked tonight. But we'll do six of them, and you only have to get five of them right in order to get full credit for it. Okay? Just as a matter of review, how old was Moses when he left Egypt in self-exile to go to Midian? 40. How old was Moses when he came back from Midian to Egypt to lead the people out? He was 80. What did Moses do between that age 40 and age 80 for that 40-year span? What? I heard married and had children. He did do that. That's correct. That's not really the answer that I was looking for. What was Moses' occupation during that 40-year period?
She didn't say shepherd.
Okay. All right. Was that Bonnie giving me that answer? Okay. All right. Bonnie, I'm sorry. I didn't hear the whole thing. I just heard married and then I lost it. Yeah. All right, he was a shepherd. What description was used to refer to the Israelites all through the book of Exodus and Leviticus? What descriptor? Stiff-necked. Do you remember we talked about that, where it came from? Do you remember what it came from? Those farm animals, beasts of burden, that had the ability to swell their neck, to stiffen their neck. And so when you need to put a yoke on two oxes to make an oxen, if you get the drift, then that animal had stiffened their neck to the point where you could not put that yoke on them. And so that there was no work done on that particular day because all you had was two giant roadblocks. And that's how God referred to his people. Would you like to be known that way? But from what we read in the scripture, was it apropos? Seems to be, for sure. True or false? God got angry, but he never turned his back on Israel. Absolutely. True or false? God recognized Israel's faith was shallow, and he eased up on the expectations. He watered down the law when Moses came back down the second time. False. Absolutely it is. Tonight we go through just a little bit of review because we've had a good study, I believe, as we've gone through this and tried to bring out things of importance to us, not just the history aspect of it, but lessons for us as well. And when we started the class, I asked you to consider Moses with this description, a friend of God. In Exodus chapter 33, Moses goes back up on the mountain after he'd been up the first time, he comes back in preparation to go up the second time. He comes back down the mountain the first time, and what does he find Israel engaging in? Idol worship, golden calf. On top of all that, Aaron said, we're going to have a feast tomorrow, and the feast turned into an orgy. Moses comes down and he says, I hear the people doing stuff they shouldn't be doing. Fusses at Aaron for not restraining the people, etc. And as a result of all that, Moses enacts some punishments on Israel. God enacts some punishments on Israel. But what's the most devastating thing that comes out of that episode? What does God say to Israel, to Moses? He says, I'm not going to be in your midst anymore. I'm not going to be with you. Did he change the job that Israel was to do? Did he say, oh, by the way, forget about the promised land. You're not going to go take it. I've got something else in mind for you. Nope. The job was still going to be the same. But God told Moses, I don't know that I'm going to be in your midst any longer. And so in that 33rd chapter, Moses asked God for a special relationship. And if anybody already had a relationship with God up at that point that was very special, who would it have been other than Moses, right? But he said, I want more of a relationship. I want to be closer to you. It's kind of hard to imagine that. But he went up on the mountain. He communed there with God. God put him in the cleft of the rock and covered him there with his hand so that he didn't see his face. And when he came back down, what was different about Moses? His face shone, right? So much so that he had to put a veil over it. People knew that Moses had been up on the mountain. I ask you what Moses did during that 40 years that he was off in Midian. He was learning how to be a shepherd. He was tending sheep when he saw the burning bush that was not consumed. Look in Acts chapter 3, because there's an important lesson about this. To get to that point to be considered to be God's friend, you first had to develop that relationship with God, and it started here in Exodus chapter 3. And this tells us something about how God puts things in front of us, but expects us to go look. Chapter 3, verse 2. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. So when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And then Moses said, here I am. What did God not do? God did not reach out and grab Moses by the collar and say, come here, I've got a job for you. Moses saw the bush. Moses wondered about the bush. Moses went and inquired. And when God saw that Moses was interested, he reached out and said, Moses, I got a job for you. God is not going to tap us on the shoulder. He's not going to grab us by the collar. He's not going to say, come here to me. But look in Jeremiah chapter 29, or I don't know if you've got... Let me just read it to you. I don't want to take the time for everybody to turn to it. Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 12. Then you will call upon me, you will go and pray to me, I will listen to you. If we seek, God is going to be there. And we are supposed to be seeking on a daily basis. Verse 13. And you will seek me and find me when you search for me with all your heart. And you will seek me. And what? You will find me. Is it a maybe? Does God say, maybe you will find me? And he does not. He said, you seek, you will find. You search for me with all your heart. In chapter 33, Moses sought God with all of his heart. I don't think there's a question about that. And so we look at some of these high points that we have gone through over the last 14 or 15 classes. We probably do not see what God sees within us. God wanted Moses to go outside of his comfort zone. And when he did, Moses grew because of it. And that's going to be true for us as well. When we look at something that we're not comfortable with, but we do it, we're going to grow because of it. You know, how many reasons did Moses think of that he was not the guy to lead Israel out of Egypt? And with every excuse that he made, what was he effectively doing? Was he not limiting God's power when he did that? God got angry with him. Do you remember that in chapter 4? God got upset. Moses took it a step too far. He made too many excuses. God didn't appreciate it a whole lot. If God says he will help, he will help. Amen. Hebrews 6:18, what does it say? God does not lie, right? God says he's going to help, then he's going to help. And if we do the job, if we look for the opportunities, and we do the job, and we give God the glory, true or false, we will be blessed. God is going to bless that action that we take when we do it on his behalf with a willing and cheerful heart, and we give him the glory for it. And that's what Jeremiah was saying in that verse that I read a couple of minutes ago from chapter 29. God did not turn his back on Israel, and certainly he won't turn his back on us. Israel gained favor in the eyes of the Egyptians, and the first century church gained favor in the eyes of the people. When we conduct our daily lives in the way that God expects us to, it will be noticed. We have a preacher who's fond of saying what? It's always right to do right. And we know that's the truth, don't we? And when we do that, people do notice. Even in this world that we have today, when we do the right thing, what God wants done, people will notice it. In Acts chapter 2, the first century church met daily with gladness and simplicity of heart, and they gained favor amongst all the people. We can stand up for what's right. We can do it every day, and people are going to notice. Do you remember what happened after the third plague? Do you remember what the third plague was? Lice. Do you remember what happened with Pharaoh's magicians after the third plague? First two could be replicated. The third one could not. And they went to Pharaoh and they said, look, we can't do this. This plague is from the hand of God. He's taking care of this. We can't make lice. Pharaoh ignored it, went on about his business. Of course, we have a few more plagues. And we work our way up to the seventh plague. Do you remember what the seventh one was, by any chance? Remember the one about hail taking out most of the crops? Do you remember what happened, or do you remember what the eighth plague was? Hail was seven. What finished off the crops? Locusts. In between the seventh and the eighth, Pharaoh's counselors went back to Pharaoh and they said, in a rhetorical question, do you not know that Egypt is ruined? They seemed to understand who God was and what God had done, even though Pharaoh himself had not done it. Look in Exodus chapter 11, verse 3. And the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, this man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's servants, and in the sight of the people. What did God promise Israel that they would do when they left Egypt regarding the treasury of Egypt and regarding the people's personal belongings? What did God promise? When you leave, you will plunder the Egyptians. And I think we take it too lightly sometimes that we just kind of, it's natural to fall into the assumption that because Egypt had all these bad things that happened to them, that people were willing to open up their pocketbook and just hand everything to the Israelites just to get rid of them. Now, was there some of that that went on? Certainly there might have been. If you had sat there through those 10 plagues, would you have been willing to pay whatever you could pay in order to get Israel out of there? And certainly you might have. But look closely at what 11:3 just says. It says that Moses was great in the eyes of who? Pharaoh's servants and all the people. We need to take this for what it says. God made a difference in the life of the Israelites. God made a difference in the life of the Egyptians. They looked favorably upon those Israelites. And the world will notice what we're doing too when we act in accordance with God's laws. When we're obedient to God. God may lead us by way of detours, by way of dead ends, dry places, but God knows what is best. He is faithful. He always keeps His promises, and we have no right to question His leadership. When Israel left Egypt, where'd they go? By the compass. East, north, west, south, what? Remember? Remember the map? Leave Egypt and they go south. Where's Canaan, by the way? If they left Egypt and they wanted to go directly to the promised land, what's the shortest route? East. Leave Egypt, go across the northern part of the Sinai Peninsula. Canaan's over there, if you're looking at the map to the right. Okay? Why did God not take them there? Do you remember? Why did He send them a different route? Pardon? That's one of the people that was in the north. Northern Arabia, the northern Sinai Peninsula, had a lot of Philistines in it, also had some Amalekites in it. Specifically, God said, if I send them that way, they might not have the heart or the faith to get through a battle, and they would rather just turn around and go back to Egypt instead of working their way forward to the promised land. God was worried about their faith in that particular instance. And so He takes them on a more southerly route. What did Egypt do after Israel had left the premises shortly thereafter? Pharaoh woke up. Pharaoh realized what he had done, began to regret his decision, saddled up the horses, got 600 choice chariots ready, got a whole bunch of foot soldiers ready, and took off after Israel. Israel goes south, wander around for a little bit, heading towards Mount Sinai. They've got to cross what body of water? And so they have the Red Sea in front of them. They look behind them and they see the dust from Pharaoh's army in hot pursuit. And what did they say to Moses? Were there not graves in Egypt to bury us there? Why'd you bring us down here? We've got no way to get out. We've got a body of water in front of us. We've got an army behind us. What are we going to do? Not very confident, are they? Well, what did they do? What did God do? God took the cloud that was in front of them, moved it behind them. That confounded the Egyptian army for a little bit. Moses stood at the Red Sea, held his hand out, put his arm out. What happened to the waters? They separated. In one night, Israel marches 2 million people across on dry land. And by the time the Egyptians figure things out and start to move forward again and get their army in the middle of that, what was a few hours earlier, a dry seabed, their chariots start to disassemble, they start to get confused again. Moses stands, puts his hands over or his arm over the Red Sea, and the water comes back together. And what did Israel see standing on the other shore of the Red Sea? They saw the dead bodies of the Egyptian soldiers come washing up. Oh, shame on them for not having much faith. We need to trust God. Even when we don't see the solution, we need to trust God. What does James tell us? The Lord's brother James in his epistle tell us the reason for trials and tribulations are so that we may have the foreknowledge of our faith and what it can handle. These things are set before us. We don't understand them. We don't know why they happen. And perhaps when they start, we don't know how we're going to get out of them. But we go to God and we ask for help. Does God help? He does. And then afterwards, we understand our faith is a little stronger and we're ready for the next trial whenever that's going to come about. And we know there's going to be another trial at some time or another. Remember Thomas, who wouldn't believe unless he saw what? Nails, or the nail holes in the hands, and put his hand inside of Jesus' side where the spear pierced it. And of course Jesus said, blessed are those who don't see and believe. Israel didn't believe, at least not enough. Their faith was shallow. God did not turn his back on them though. What about our daily bread? Remember God's blessing? Complain less. Trust God? Complain less. Obey God? Complain less. God gives us our daily bread, and then tomorrow He gives us our daily bread, and then the next day He gives us our daily bread, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day. Why did God only provide one day at a time? Why do you think? Pardon? Well, we're not promised tomorrow. That's true. Why else? If you're going to go out and attack a problem, what's our tendency to want to do to solve that issue? We want to look at the whole thing. We want to see it from start to finish. We want to fix it not just today, but every day, what Tracy was talking about. We have a dependency to depend on us because we need to figure out a way to provide for us, not just for one day, but for 10. God said, don't do it that way. What was the only day that you got to collect more than one day's worth of food? Friday. And why? What was the big deal? Collect for 2 days because what was going to happen on Saturday, or what was supposed to happen on Saturday? Saturday was a day of rest and reflection on God. So we're not going to collect food on that day. And so for that day and that day only, on Friday, you collect enough for two and it won't ruin. But what happened if you collected too much on Monday, Tuesday, you know, and the other days? It ruined. God said, only collect one day at a time. James also talks about that. Remember, he says, what is our life? It is but a vapor. We should say, if the Lord wills, we will live here and do this or that. Life is short. Trust God. James also says that when we depend upon ourselves and we try to run ahead of God, that doing so is arrogance and boasting. And that is evil. Not a place that we want to be. Not a place that we need to be, right? And then we talked about the battle with the Amalekites. Holding up one another's hands. Behind every great leader is a support team. Do you remember who Amalek was, by the way? Esau's grandson. So when the Amalekites come and attack the rear part of the procession of the Israelites going to Mount Sinai, they're attacking their cousins, so to speak. Remember what God said about that, by the way? Remember he got upset because the Amalekites came and attacked the rear of the guard? Who would be in the rear section of that march going towards Sinai? Those that were weakest, moms with their kids, those who were sick. And the Amalekites tried, well, it was dirty pool. It was bad form to attack them that way. And Joshua got in the middle of that and was the field general for that particular encounter. But I want to go forward to 1 Samuel chapter 15 first. We'll come back to the battle in just a second. God got upset about this. He didn't forget it. In 1 Samuel 15, he tells Samuel to go tell Saul to go take out the Amalekites. Take them all out. Nobody lives. And that included the livestock, the sheep, the goats, the cattle, and all of that. What did Saul do? Do you remember? Saul went down there and he battled the Amalekites and he wiped them out. Except the king named Agag, and he brought him back, and the livestock, the sheep, the goats, the cows, etc., etc. Did he do what God said do? God came to Samuel and he said, you know, it grieves me that I made Saul king. And Samuel went back to Saul and he said, why did you disobey God? Saul's answer is going to remind you somewhat of Aaron, or at least it does me. Because Saul says, I did obey God. I went to the Amalekites, I wiped them out, I brought back Agag, and I brought back some animals, some livestock, etc. And also on the way back, I stopped and had a sacrifice of those that were the best animals. So yes, I obeyed God. Did he? And he did not. That's not what God said do. On top of the fact that Saul was not a Levite. And at that point of the Israelites' history, had no right to offer that sacrifice. Does that sound like anyone else I know? I did obey. Does that sound a little bit like Aaron? What'd you do, Aaron? Well, I don't know. I just took the gold and I threw it in the fire and a gold calf came out. It's not my fault. Because one of the things that Saul also told Samuel was, you know, when I did all this, I kind of got afraid of the people because the people were kind of pressing in on me and I didn't want to stand in their way. Well, if you're going to listen to the people instead of God, how's God going to react to that? Now, back to the battle. Back to the point of all this. When the Amalekites attacked the Israelites, Joshua, who's referred to just a few chapters after this as a young man, was the field general. He was on the battle floor, actually slinging the swords and the arrows and the spears and all that kind of stuff, leading Israel into battle. Where was Moses? He was on the hill. What happened when Moses held his hands up? Israel prevailed in battle, right? And what happened when his hands went down? Amalekites started to prevail in battle. Who came in to help the matters out? Remember Aaron and Hur? They came in and they held Moses' arms up. And when they held the arms up, Israel prevailed. And eventually they sent Moses down on a rock. And they just held his arms up for the duration of that particular battle. And Israel prevailed. Joshua needed Moses. Moses needed Aaron and Hur. Joshua was on the field doing the fighting. Moses was up on the hill. Aaron and Hur get an assist. But the point of all this is that it takes a lot of people to do a lot of different things. And whether or not we're the field general in the middle of the battle that's leading the army, or whether or not we're Aaron and we're Hur, who's up on the mountainside doing the not glamorous job of holding Moses' arms up. All of it is obeying God. Israel's relationship with God was based on grace, and ours is too. Israel's relationship with God was based on their willingness to accept God's terms, and our relationship is the same way. Israel's relationship with God was based on their continuing to keep the covenant, and certainly ours is as well. Do you remember what the things were that Israel saw when they were on the mountain? Saw and heard. Israel looked up and they saw lightning, fire, smoke, a cloud. They heard thunder. They heard trumpets. They felt an earthquake. They saw all of these things. They saw the face of Moses when he came back down from Sinai the second time. And it was so bright that he had to put a veil over it. And which one of these things was it that saved Israel? It was none of them. It was God's grace. And God's grace extends to us as well. Unless we're willing to obey God and overcome our own pride, we will not be the recipients of God's grace. Two or three years ago, maybe longer, I don't know, time flies, Eric Owens was here for a gospel meeting. Do you remember that? He taught a lesson one evening on James. And the lesson was about grace. And the way he put it was that every time we encounter God's grace, we are given instructions that, if followed, produce faith. We are saved through grace by an active faith. I encourage you to go back to that lesson. It's on our website. Find it and listen to it. God told Israel after 9 plagues, one more plague and I'm going to let you go. What was Israel's responsibility during the first 9 plagues? What did they do that was active participation on their part during the first 9? It's kind of a trick question. They didn't do anything, did they? It was pretty much just sit back and watch God's power. What did they do after the 10th plague? Or I'm sorry, I said that wrong. What did they do right before the 10th plague? Pardon? They did the Passover stuff. They had a sacrifice. They were to take a pure and unspotted lamb. They were to make a sacrifice of it. They were to do what with the blood from it? Take that blood, paint that blood on the top of the doorpost and on the sides as well, and the destroyer will pass over that. And so it goes for this event and so on, that our faith is always a work in progress. God's grace will be extended to us through that faith. Israel was cleansed by the blood and free from uncleanness. The Lord's church is also cleansed by the blood of Jesus and made free of contamination of sin. Remember, I said at one point during this class that it's all about the blood. God went to great lengths in Exodus and Leviticus to put in place a spiritual system for Israel to be able to grow close to Him. It had to do with blood of bulls and goats. Do you remember when we talk about the sacrifices, there were 5 basic types of sacrifices, but they fell within 2 categories. The first one was a voluntary set of sacrifices, and those voluntary sacrifices were for the person to have a more intimate relation with God as you went about presenting these sacrifices to God. And then there were 2 other sets of sacrifices that fell under the mandatory category that had to do with sacrifices for sin. You know, Moses got very close to God in that 33rd chapter when he went up top of the mountain and he developed a relationship. That relationship was for Israel to develop as a whole also. We all have a responsibility to God to develop a personal relationship to him. But we also have a responsibility to our brothers and sisters within the church. We cannot have a relationship with God that does not include both a church relationship and a personal relationship. Israel made the, look at Israel. They had sins that were impacting the whole camp. There were sacrifices that had to do with sin within the whole camp for the entirety of it, as well as things that had to do with each Israelite individually. And you couldn't separate the two. Moses couldn't separate the two. We cannot separate the two. The priest that offered the sacrifice, the Levite priest that offered the sacrifice in Exodus and Leviticus in the Old Testament times, was he perfect himself? Or did that priest also have sin? And certainly the answer to that is he was a sinful person just like the people that he was presenting the sacrifice for. In Jeremiah chapter 31, what did the prophet say was going to happen to that old law? It was going to give way for the new one, right? We have a priest in that new law after the order of Melchizedek. That priest is a perfect priest, a sinless priest. And when he went on that cross and made that ultimate sacrifice, he then became able to go into the most holy place on our behalf. If you remember what the tabernacle layout was, there was the outer court, there was the holy place, and then there was the most holy place. And who went into that most holy place? Only the high priest. Jesus is our high priest. Hebrews chapter 9 makes it clear about the blood of bulls and goats no longer covering our sin. But certainly Jesus' shed blood covers our sin. The tabernacle was built according to God's plan through good leadership. It was built with the help and the liberal gifts of the entire congregation. We talked in the past about the first fruits, the concept of first fruits. God expects sacrificial giving. There's no way to soft sell it. God expected Israel to give back to God that which was the best and then figure out a way to live on what was left. How does that apply to us in our lives? Where do we put God? What kind of images, graven or virtual graven, do we have between us and God that take the place of that which is our best? This is a touchy subject. And this is something that I'm not sure that we like to be honest with ourselves about. But how many times did we talk about God is light, in Him there is no darkness? You can't play it halfway. God expects our best. Period. Was that one? Thank you. You shall have no other gods before you. You shall make no graven images. How many gods can we serve, by the way? Matthew chapter 6 says what? You cannot serve two masters. Either if you love the one and you will what? Despise the other. We know that to be the truth. And yet we will continue to try to play the line, to walk the line, to selectively be obedient to God every day. For some reason we believe that we have a superpower that allows us to go step our toe over into something bad and be able to pull it back and not be impacted by it. God says it won't happen that way. John chapter 1 verse 15 that I alluded to just a second ago, God is light, in Him there is no darkness. There are no shades of gray in God, and there can't be in us either. I'm going to run out of time. We need to request of God a more personal relationship. How do we do that? Moses physically went up the mountain. How can we do it? Right here. Every time we open this book, we are going up the mountain with God. The question is going to be, how far do we get? You know, God spoke the law, then the people sinned. God re-spoke the law. What happened after that? Did the law change? The law did not change. And when we look closely at chapters 32, 33, and 34 of the book of Exodus, there is no doubt the nature of God regarding what He stands for. One truth in today's society is obsolete just about the time that it's spoken. How many truths are there in a morally relativistic society? There's a bunch of them. How many truths is there? How many truths are there with God? And what time's left, I want to mention the prodigal son, Luke chapter 15. What do we learn from that? The prodigal son left, he squandered his father's inheritance. The prodigal father stood on the porch, metaphorically, watching for him to come home. The prodigal father did not change. If he had changed, what would he have done? If the prodigal father had compromised and eased up on whatever the issues were that caused his son to leave, what would the prodigal son have had to come back to? In today's society, we would be applauded if we were the prodigal father and we compromised and we made some changes that allowed us to have some type of relationship or allowed him to have a relationship with that son, because that's the way the world works it today. That's not the way God works it. God spoke it, and that's the end of it. And sometimes it's painful when we have those relationships and we draw that line. But that's exactly what God said do, and that's what the parable in Luke chapter 15 of the prodigal son illustrates. I include here a verse from 1 Corinthians talking about when we look at the wisdom of God throughout this summary of Exodus and Leviticus that we have been through. Certainly we recognize that God's wisdom is greater than ours. And then if we want the short version of, to me, what all of the Exodus and Leviticus study was about, then it's all about the blood, it's about details matter, and it's about going to the summit and being with God. Questions, comments, or do you have an outtake that you want to say something about regarding the story or the study that we've had on Exodus and Leviticus? Or have you been saved by the bell during the last period and now it's time to go?
Did we get straight A?
Yeah, everybody got a straight A. Everybody got 6 out of 6 on the pop quiz. Good job. Thank you so much for your attention.